This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
And this is Geek Squawks. My name is Jeff Sandhu, together with Culture Pop's Matt Armitage. We've actually talked about, you know, something about how human-like we want robots to be, how lifelike we want robots to be.
Yeah, it kind of feels like I've spent the whole of 2018 talking about this.
But, you know, this brain hacking consequences, it's starting to come to light.
No, it is really important, and that's why I have been talking about it a lot. And people come up to me and talk about it as well, because the idea of AI and robots is something that, it's not just in the popular consciousness, it does really frighten people, I think.
Actually, that is true, though. A lot of random people who, you know that we do this kind of shows, one of the conversations that they love to have is just like, so your thoughts about this, you know, robots taking over AI, us is real. And you see it even in press releases, in announcements, in researchers. And these are like, you know, agencies that are higher up in,
Absolutely. And in a way, I kind of like it because it's much better than people coming up and saying, what smartphone should I buy? The answer is any of them. They're all really good. Doesn't matter.
I used to get that the first few years. Actually, I still do get it every now and then.
So I'm happy with the AI thing rather than the what smartphone should I buy?
Well, this rise of robots, you know, new wave of television shows have appeared, films have appeared, video games as well, and, you know, radio shows like ours. As well, you know, we're talking about it. Westworld, for example, right? They sort of have this vision where, you know, we could develop realistic androids, and it's the humans who do things to them, like, you know, you would raid them and murder them. And then in Blade Runner 2049, androids have replaced humans as sex workers and manual laborers. And then in the recently released video game Detroit Becoming Human, androids are nannies and carers and even pop stars. They're omnipresent home in city life.
I mean, you know, I'm not really a gamer.
And I'm not a gamer,
person, but I'm really interested to play Detroit Become Human because it does sound really interesting, because we don't actually have that ability to put ourselves into that environment and test to see what it might be like. So I would be really interested just to kind of immerse myself in that for a while.
Interesting, yeah. So the current wave of this android fiction kind of centers around, like, what would happen when the line between human and machines becomes blur, right? At what point do robots deserve rights? And, you know, is it when they reach like a certain level of intelligence, or is it when they develop a capacity for emotion, creativity, free will? It's a question that we've also been asking for a long time, and we've been discussing for
it's a question that ethicists are going to have to deal with, lawmakers are going to have to deal with, because it contains things like property rights. Is a machine going to be your property? Does a machine have the right to own other pieces of property? Can a machine own land? All of these kind of things. There's a lot that has to be worked out. But it's kind of interesting, because a lot of people say that we shouldn't give machines the ability to have emotion. But for me, I find it very weird that we wouldn't do that, because the idea is that only humans have emotion.
Yes.
But it's not true.
Huh.
Animals have emotions
too,
as well.
That's,
you know,
true.
most living things. So if we're getting into
But are robots living thing?
But that's going to be the thing. I think we are going to see at some point that there is going to be some biological crossover.
Yeah.
We are also going to see these chips being implanted in our brains. So,
so
as the machines become more human, we are going to
be becoming more robots.
More machine-like. Yeah, exactly. So there will be some ground in the middle.
Yeah.
What I do agree with a lot of the people is when they start talking about whether robots should be built to look like humans.
Yes.
I don't think there's any great need for the machines to look like us. We look like us.
Yeah.
You know,
me and you look completely different. So.
Well, completely, yeah. And we're not trying to engineer cats to look more like us. Some people want to look more like cats, but that's a completely
different
thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, we can allow them to develop their own forms, because as well, we've seen that insect-like robots, which arguably are far more scary than human-type robots, but that makes more sense, because we still have problems making humanoid robots move. We don't have the same problems making insect robots move.
Yeah, but like, you know, Google demonstrated their Android assistant before, right? Where they had a natural conversation with over the phone to book like a haircut. And we've played that clip before.
We have, and I still don't understand why it freaks people out. I know
because
it
of the
does.
Ums and ahs and, you know, it felt like, wow, that was just so human-like. And you can't distinct, you know, is this a robocall or is
but
this...
Why does it matter? That's the thing that I don't understand. Why
so then
does
why
it
would
matter?
It matter if the robot looks like a human or not, right?
It doesn't matter to me. I mean, I'm just saying that there's no real reason to, because it's not the optimal form for the robot to take. Mm. We've developed our form through natural evolution. It doesn't mean that we impose that on another form. But in terms of the intelligence, there's no reason for... the machines to be distinguishable from humans. I mean, what, you know, you get into a conversation and every 3 minutes it has to play like a message saying, I am a robot. I am a robot. You know,
maybe not like that.
No, but yeah. If we're talking about machines that have a kind of natural intelligence and an intelligence that matches ours or even surpasses it, then I don't understand why we have to make these differentiations. I mean, you know, we've taught sign language to various higher apes. Mm, mm. We don't ask them to identify themselves as apes when they start signing.
In Japan, they're actually a lot more acceptable to having an android or a robot like that looks a lot like human than compared to the West in Europe. Because apparently a study was done that, and one study where people asked if a robot was interacting with children, this was in Europe, whether or not it would be ethically acceptable if the children got attached to the robot. Only 40% thought that was acceptable. But in Japan, it's the country home to the creepy Erica, which is the most realistic female humanoid in existence. And also Gatebox AI's Azuma. You would have seen this on Facebook going around. It's that holographic girl in a jar that combines with an Alexa-like home assistant functionality and this very cute anime look and simulated differential personality. And it just kind of like... You know, oh, welcome home, you know, I missed you and that kind of stuff. And it's, you know, two different kind of cultures having a very different kind of view of this.
Because I have more of a problem with the servile kind of robots. Mm. I want to see robots that are actually more our equals than the machines that are just there to service. Because when you look at TV shows like Westworld, part of the issue is, again, because of the hierarchy, humans are treating... the robots, as you said, they're murdering them and raping them and they're acting out all of these weird and bizarre fantasies. Yeah. And I think that kind of shows a marked lack of respect for the kind of intelligence that these machines are going to possess in the future. Mm.
I honestly, going back to the Star Wars theme that we had at the start of the show, actually, I would love to have like an R2-D2 kind of assistant instead of someone that looks like a human.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially if he could open up and he's a trash can as well.
That'll be great, yeah. Anyways, we'll be right back with King of the Crowd after this, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
And we're back. This is Geek Squawks. My name is Jeff Sandu, together with Matt Amatate's Culture Pop. It's time for King of the Crowd. What do we have?
Well, we actually have a King of the Crowd. Ah. We don't have a Down in the Dumps.
Thankfully.
We have a musical toy for kids that won't make you want to kill yourself. Now, you know when you have a lot of these kind of keyboards you know, they just repeat the same sounds.
It's like a knife to the ear.
Yeah, absolutely.
Stabbing constantly.
So the Blip Blocks is a synthesizer that's for kids. And it does look remarkably similar to all these Fisher-Price type things. So it's got the... big colorful buttons and the joystick controls and the paddles and all that kind of stuff.
But a synthesizer. Wow.
It's a proper synthesizer. So it has hundreds and hundreds of different sounds and patterns. Nice. So your kids can actually make genuine music with this machine. It has its own little speaker. And it's something that will stay with them, not just for when they're sort of 3 or 4. It's something that can stick with them through to adulthood because... despite the fact it is pitched at kids, it is a fully professional synthesizer. It has MIDI outs, it has audio port outs, and it has all the kind of gates and modulations that professional musicians use with synthesizers. So it's not actually it's a synthesizer that looks like a toy rather than just being a toy. So I find this kind of cool because it's the kind of thing that kids and their parents can really enjoy together. And you can continue to use it and play with it year after year and get more and more out of it as the kids get into the process of making music.
Mm. How much was this?
It's $139, which, okay, for a kid's toy, that's kind of expensive, but for a synthesizer. It's actually pretty reasonable. They should be ready by about October 2018.
That's
they
all
ship right. globally. As I said, $139. You can also bulk buy if you have a bunch of kids or you want one for yourself as well as your kids. I really like this. Mm. I can imagine getting one for myself, but if you do have a kid who's into music, this is a great place to start. The Blip Blocks, it's on Indiegogo.
What I think would be interesting is also, I wouldn't be surprised to actually see like a big name artist or just an adult DJ who's just trying to make a name for himself or be different using something like this. Because this just looks like one of those Fisher Price toys.
No, it is.
It will stand out.
Yeah, it really will. But it is actually a genuinely useful piece of equipment.
Yeah, yeah. Anyways, it's World Cup season. Matt, I know you're not the biggest fan of football, so just bear with me throughout this, because we're trying to talk about the physics of taking the perfect World Cup penalty. So in between, I'll just sort of, you know, ask your thoughts, like, you know, what are your take on this? Just bear with me for a while. Yeah, Matt? All right. Now, the penalty was invented on February 14, 1891. It was actually the last minute of the FA Cup quarterfinal between Notts County and Stoke City when a defender for County stopped the shot on the line with his hand. So Stoke were then awarded the free kick just centimetres from the goal line, and the goalkeeper, as perfectly legal at that time, stood right in front of the ball, and the Stoke player, unable to do anything other than just kicking it straight at him. And then a meeting happened at the International Football Association board in Glasgow on June 2nd, 1891, and a motion for a new penalty kick law was tabled by the Irish FA. And that is where we've now gotten into, you know, the 12 yards from the goal line, and the keeper could advance at least 6 yards to save it. But over time, they've been tweaked and finessed into what we know and love or hate today. So, yeah. We're all right with it, Matt? Yeah, still with me? All right. So penalty shootouts were introduced into World Cup in 1978, and only 26 have taken place before this 2018 tournament started. And the chances of scoring a penalty is actually around 70%, and it's kind of reflected with the World Cup penalty success rate shootout at this point in time. 170 successes from 240 penalties taken from the shootouts before the tournament in Russia. But why 12 yards? It's apparently very simple, because that's what the FA decided in 1891, and it will never change. You're doing good here, Matt, still? Awesome. Right, so if you move the ball any closer or further away, the odds actually start to tip too far away one way or the other, right? So John Wesson, he points out in the book, The Science of Soccer, taking into account the air drag and a perfectly directed penalty, if you hit it at 80 miles per hour into the top corner of the goal, in theory, a defeat goalkeeper from 35 yards. But if you move it 10 yards closer to the goal, the likelihood of scoring rises steadily. At 3 yards, it's almost 100%. So give it me here, Matt. Still all right? Awesome. All right. So seemingly by fluke, 12 yards, it's actually pretty much the sweet spot. So as you would have probably seen, especially you, Matt, you've seen that game as well, so right? Yeah. So Harry Kane, he showed up in his two spot kicks against Panama, and he just relied on physics to score the perfect penalty. It's about two things: speed and direction. 80 miles per hour, and the goalkeeper has about one third of a second to make the save. So the only chance of actually making a save is just guessing right. And that's where placement comes. A research was done by the University of Bath in 2012 found there's a diving envelope for any given keeper if they push off in any direction with maximum force. This is like a half circle from the center of the goal. Get with me still, Matt? Perfect. So the probability of scoring inside this diving envelope is only 50%, but the probability of scoring outside of the diving envelope is about 80%, and the outside of the diving envelope is towards the far corners of the edge of the goal. So in terms of goal area, the keeper gives it a little bit of a technical advantage. They can reach 70% of the goal area, leaving the penalty taker only 30% of the goal to aim to dramatically improve the chances of scoring a goal. And if they hit it, they variably would score. What I thought was also very interesting is the physics of the ironic error, where you're still okay with me. I see you're hanging on tight. You're doing good. All right. So there's this thing called also the ironic error, where it's the effect of a result player subconsciously assessing all of these likely outcomes, and then it just becomes overwhelmed by it. So in a high-pressure situation like the World Cup penalty shootout, knowing that you could hit the post overrides the most statistical likely outcome that you should score. Simply put, under immense pressure to score a penalty, the mind is actually drawn ever closer to focusing on how you could miss. So the result, though, you would miss. But thankfully, England, first time in a very long time, I think since 2006 or something like that, they've won a penalty shootout in the World Cup. All right. So now, Matt, back to proper geek stuff, Geek Tunes.
Right, well, yes, I'm back. This is a track from Alt-J. Now, they're going to be performing at the Good Vibes Festival later this month. This is a new track from their album, which came out last year. This is a reworked version of In Cold Blood, featuring Pusha T and Twin Shadow, which gives it a really nice kind of urban and very kind of skeletal feel. As I said, Alt-J with In Cold Blood.
BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.